Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Kaz.
And I'm Em. And in this episode, we'll be focusing on a biblical character whose primary reputation is that of a betrayer. Can you guess who it is, Kaz?
It has to be Judas, right?
Boom, yes, right in one. Judas Iscariot is best known for being the disciple who betrayed Jesus to the authorities, which then led to Jesus' arrest and ultimately his death. Now, over the centuries, his name has become synonymous with betrayal and treachery. If someone calls you a Judas, you can be sure it's not a compliment. So, Kaz, what do you know about Judas?
I must confess, I don't really know a great deal about him. He betrayed Jesus with a kiss, as I recall. But apart from that, I always thought of him as quite a mysterious character.
Yeah, despite the fact that Judas is such a well-known biblical figure, and despite the fact that he plays such a significant role in the New Testament stories about Jesus, he's only mentioned two or three times in each of the Gospels and once in the book of Acts. And some of the information given about him in these texts is contradictory or vague. It seems as though each of the gospel writers has a slightly different view of Judas, and that's reflected in the ways they characterise him.
Okay, so how are we going to tackle Judas in this episode, Em?
I thought we could take a closer look at what the Bible says about Judas and explore some of the things that are left unclear, especially his motivations for betraying Jesus and the significance of his response to Jesus' arrest. Along the way, we'll explore themes of betrayal and remorse that are central to Judas's character, and I'm hoping you'll help me think about how these themes also play out in real-life cases of crime and criminality.
Sounds good.
So, just to give a content warning before we start, we'll be talking briefly about suicide in this episode, as well as other themes and stories relating to sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and the murder of a child. So, if you find any of these topics particularly triggering, please take care as you listen to this episode.
Yeah, and we'll leave links to some relevant support services in our show notes too.
Let's start off by seeing what the New Testament has to say about Judas. As I've already said, he's mentioned in all four Gospels, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And the first time we hear about him is when he's introduced as one of Jesus' 12 disciples. Now, the Gospels of Mark and Matthew specifically introduce him as the disciple who betrayed Jesus. And in Luke, he's introduced as the disciple who, quote, became a traitor. But John's Gospel goes even further by associating Judas with the devil. Kaz, can you read out John chapter 6, verses 70 to 71, please?
Sure. In verse 70, Jesus tells his disciples, "Have I not chosen the 12 of you? Yet one of you is a devil." Then in verse 71, the narrator adds, and I quote, "He meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, who, although one of the 12, was later to betray him." Okay, so from the very first time he's mentioned, all the gospel writers leave us in no doubt about Judas's role in this story, don't they?
Yeah, and it's interesting that, on the one hand, he's undoubtedly a member of Jesus's inner circle, one of his closest followers. That suggests that he was a strong supporter of Jesus's ministry and was willing to work alongside the other disciples, healing the sick, casting out demons, and preaching about the coming kingdom of God. But on the other hand, each gospel clearly marks out Judas Iscariot as being different from the others because he's a traitor and even a devil, according to John.
So what changed then, Em? Why did Judas go from being a loyal disciple to effectively throwing Jesus under the bus?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, Kaz, and I'm sorry to tell you, but there's no clear answer.
What? But don't any of the gospels tell us?
Well, sort of, but the problem is that they're not consistent in what they say about Judas's motives.
Oh, that's so frustrating.
Yeah, it is, but let's try to figure it out.
Okay.
So the first motive that sometimes gets suggested is plain and simple greed. Kaz, can you read out Matthew chapter 26, verses 3 to 5, and then verses 14 to 16, please?
Certainly. So verses 3 to 5 say, "Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the courtyard of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and they conspired to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the Passover festival, or there may be a riot among the people. Then in verses 14 to 16 we read, "Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What will you give me if I betray him to you?' They paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he began to look for an opportunity to betray Jesus." Okay, so it sounds as though Judas's primary motive is money here.
It certainly sounds that way.
Do you know if there's any significance to the 30 pieces of silver that Judas has offered? I mean, does the sum have any symbolic meaning?
Yeah, I think this is an allusion to other texts from the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament. 30 pieces of silver are mentioned in Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 to 13, where it seems to refer to the prophet's wages for being a shepherd to the people of Israel who are, quote, doomed to slaughter.
Okay, so what's the significance of these Zechariah verses to the Judas story?
Well, it's hard to tell because biblical scholars aren't really sure what the Zechariah passage actually means.
Okay, so that's not very helpful, Em.
Don't worry, Kaz, because there's another passage in John's Gospel that also suggests Judas may have been motivated by money when he betrayed Jesus. John chapter 12, verses 4 to 7, repeats a story told in the other three Gospels, where a woman takes a pot of expensive ointment and uses it to anoint Jesus' feet. In the other three Gospels, different people object to this woman's actions, but in the Gospel of John, it's only Judas who complains. Can you read this passage for us, Kaz?
Sure. Judas says, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 pieces of silver and the money given to the poor?" Then the narrator jumps in and explains to us that Judas said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. He kept the common purse and used to steal what was put in it. Ah, okay, so John accuses Judas of dipping his hand in the communal purse, but that's not mentioned in the other Gospels, is it?
No, it's not.
What strikes me here, though, is that if the woman's pot of ointment is worth 300 pieces of silver, then Judas's payment of 30 pieces of silver in the Gospel of Matthew doesn't sound like that much at all. So I'm not sure that's evidence of his so-called greed.
No, and it strikes me too that Judas doesn't sound like a man who's motivated by wealth. He chose to follow Jesus, living an itinerant lifestyle with no financial benefits at all. Why would he have developed this sudden urge to make money?
That's a good point. But if Judas doesn't betray Jesus for cold hard cash, what else could have motivated him?
Well, the Gospels of Luke and John do suggest another reason. In Luke chapter 22, verses 3 to 6, we read, "Satan entered into Judas called Iscariot, who was one of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers of the temple police about how he might betray Jesus to them. They were greatly pleased and agreed to give him money. So he consented and began to look for an opportunity to betray him."
What does it mean that Satan entered into Judas?
Yeah, so some scholars suggest it means that Judas became possessed by a demon. In first century Palestine, demon possession was believed to cause various illnesses, including mental illness. An important part of Jesus' ministry centered on casting out demons and healing the possessed, and he gave his disciples the authority to do the same.
So if Luke is saying Judas was possessed by a demon, would that provide a sort of excuse for why he betrayed Jesus? Is it suggesting he didn't have control over his own mind or his behaviour?
Well, Luke seems to be saying that Judas came under Satan's influence through his possession, and because of this, he did what Satan wanted him to do, which was to put an end to Jesus' ministry and mission. Biblical scholar Bart Ehrman puts it well when he says that Satan, quote, used Judas as his henchman to do his dirty work.
Okay. But if Jesus and the other disciples could cast out demons, why didn't they cast out Judas's demon? Or didn't they realise he was possessed? And that raises another question that's always troubled me. Was Jesus aware that Judas would betray him?
So not all of the Gospels make that clear, but in John's Gospel, Jesus does seem to recognise Judas as his betrayer. Kaz, could you summarise John chapter 13, verses 21 to 30 for us, please?
Sure. So the disciples are sitting with Jesus at the Last Supper when Jesus says to them, "Very truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me." The other disciples ask him who he's referring to, and he tells them it's the one he's going to give a morsel of bread to. Then he hands the bread to Judas. Next we read that, and I'm quoting, "After Judas received the piece of bread, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, 'Do quickly what you are going to do.'" And then we're told that after receiving the piece of bread, Judas immediately went out, and it was night. Ah, that's so interesting. Jesus seems to have foreknowledge that Judas is the one who will ultimately betray him. And Jesus doesn't try to stop him, does he? He basically tells him to get on with it.
Yeah, that's right.
So other than money and demon possession, are there any other theories about Judas's motivations for betraying Jesus?
Yeah, there are quite a few. Some scholars suggest that Judas may have become disenchanted with Jesus's teaching and ministry. Perhaps he thought Jesus had become too focused on some heavenly vision of the future kingdom of God, rather than dealing with the Jewish people's current oppression under Roman imperial rule. So maybe Judas hoped that Jesus' arrest would trigger a confrontation between Jesus and the Roman authorities, which in turn might incite Jesus to begin a Jewish revolution against their Roman oppressors.
That's such an interesting idea. And it makes me think back to the scene with the woman who anointed Jesus with her expensive oil. Jesus says that, and I quote, "She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." Now, if Judas has his hopes pinned on Jesus leading a revolution against the Roman oppressors, then he must be wondering how on earth Jesus is going to fulfill that role if he's already talking about his imminent death.
Yeah, Bart Ehrman picks up on that too. He points out that in three of the Gospels, this anointing event happens just before Judas offers to betray Jesus. Ehrman suggests that this might have been the final straw for Judas, because how would Jesus inaugurate God's new kingdom here on earth if he was going to die soon? This could have been the critical moment where Judas lost faith in Jesus' ministry. He wasn't the Messiah Judas thought he was, and so his betrayal came from a place of bitter disappointment and disillusionment.
And that makes sense, doesn't it? But I have another question for you, Em. What exactly did Judas's betrayal entail? I mean, how did he help the authorities arrest Jesus? I've never really been clear about what he actually did.
Well, none of the Gospels make that clear, but his main role seems to have been leading a group of armed men to Jesus and identifying him to them.
Okay, this has always puzzled me. I guess I just assumed that the enemies of Jesus would know what he looked like and where to find him, so why would they need Judas to identify him for them?
But don't forget, Kaz, these events did take place before social media was a thing. The chief priests couldn't just Google Jesus of Nazareth or find a picture of him on Instagram. They would have heard a lot about him, but might never have seen him face to face or know where he was staying while he was in Jerusalem.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
So, let's take a look at the moment of Jesus' betrayal. This is how Mark's Gospel describes it in chapter 14, verses 43 to 46. We read, "Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd, armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer, Judas, had arranged a signal with them. 'The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard.' Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, 'Rabbi,' and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him."
Okay, so this leads me on to yet another question. Why did Judas feel the need to identify Jesus by kissing him? Why not just point him out to the men who were waiting to arrest him?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Some scholars suggest that it was a common practice in Jewish circles at the time for a disciple to kiss their teacher or rabbi as a mark of respect. So maybe Judas kissed Jesus because that's what Jesus would expect him to do.
In other words, Jesus wouldn't realise anything was amiss?
Yeah, exactly. The kiss could have served a dual purpose. First, it helped to identify Jesus to the men who were there to arrest him. And second, it could have stopped Jesus getting suspicious about why Judas had turned up with all these armed men. But Bart Ehrman suggests it could be another allusion to Jewish sacred scripture. In 2 Samuel chapter 20, verses 9 to 10, King David's right-hand man Joab meets with David's nephew Amasa, whom he suspects is disloyal to David. We're told that, quote, Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, but Amasa did not notice the sword in Joab's left hand. Joab struck him in the belly so that his entrails poured out on the ground, and he died.
Whoa, that is a treacherous kiss. There's something so cruel and underhand about using a kiss as a ruse to commit harm against another person, because a kiss is such an intimate act.
Yeah, I agree. And what's really interesting is that the Greek word used to describe Judas's kiss is kataphilao, which means to kiss affectionately or tenderly. Biblical scholar Robert Miles suggests that this seemingly intimate moment between Judas and Jesus makes the act of betrayal feel even more shocking.
Do you think Judas was only play-acting here? You know, trying to lull Jesus into a false sense of security? Or could there have been a bit of affection or tenderness to that kiss?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell from the text what was going on in Judas's mind here. It could have been an entirely treacherous kiss. But then again, it could also have been Judas's way of saying sorry or saying goodbye to the man he once clearly had a huge amount of respect for, or maybe even loved.
Yes, I guess you could read it either way. Do all four Gospels mention this kiss?
No, they don't. Mark, Matthew, and Luke do mention Judas's plans to kiss Jesus, but only Mark and Matthew tell us that the kiss took place. And it's not clear in either text if Jesus knows what Judas is up to. But in Luke chapter 22, verses 47 to 48, we're left in no doubt that Jesus is wise to Judas's plans. We read, quote, "While Jesus was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, 'Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?'"
Ooh, interesting. So Luke doesn't clarify whether or not the kiss actually took place, but makes clear that Jesus was expecting it.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about the Gospel of John?
Interestingly, there's absolutely no kissing in John.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in fact, the betrayal scene is depicted quite differently. Judas doesn't identify Jesus at all. Instead, Jesus takes control of the situation and identifies himself to the crowd who are waiting to arrest him.
I must say that on a dramatic and emotional level, the scene of Jesus' arrest is far more powerful when we imagine that Jesus doesn't know what's about to happen, because we don't often dwell on Jesus' response to Judas here, do we? I mean, who knows? Perhaps he felt the most immense shock and grief that someone he counted as a close associate, even a beloved friend, could do this to him. If the kiss signals affection and intimacy, then the arrest happening right after it, without Jesus having foreknowledge, would have just felt so devastating.
Yeah, I think the inclusion of the kiss helps to capture the real trauma of betrayal.
Okay, so how would you define betrayal, Em?
Well, it's usually defined as the experience of being harmed or let down in some way by someone you trust, like a friend or a partner, a colleague, a family member, or anyone you expect will be loyal to you. Feeling betrayed by someone implies that there's a bond or relationship between you and the person who's betrayed you.
Could you say a bit more about that?
Sure, let me give you an example. So if my wallet got stolen by a random stranger as I was walking along the street, I'd probably feel quite cross and upset, but I don't think I'd feel betrayed because I'd have no expectations of loyalty or trust from that stranger. But let's just say that you stole my wallet, Kaz.
Oh no.
I think I'd feel really betrayed because I trust you and I'd expect you not to be dishonest or disloyal to me.
I promise I will never steal your wallet. Again.
Thanks, Kaz.
That's okay.
Now, I'm sure we've all felt betrayed at some point in our lives.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we all know how much it hurts, even when the betrayal is fairly minor. And with more serious forms of betrayal, such as infidelity, theft, rape, and other forms of violence, it can have a really traumatizing impact on the person who's been betrayed. Psychologists refer to this as betrayal trauma, and it can seriously damage our emotional well-being. It can also lead us to experience a strong sense of grief and loss because the relationship we had so much faith in has been damaged, sometimes beyond repair.
I wonder if Jesus felt betrayal trauma. I mean, Judas was one of his inner circle of trusted disciples, and going by the gospel accounts, Jesus had known him for around 3 or maybe 4 years. So I can only assume that these men may well have forged a strong or even intimate relationship.
Yeah, that's true.
I also wonder if the other disciples also experienced betrayal trauma. Judas was one of them. They've travelled together and been in each other's company almost continually over the span of Jesus' ministry.
And the fact that the disciples are this really tight-knit group makes me wonder if they'd perceived Judas's actions as some form of cultural betrayal.
Oh, what's cultural betrayal?
So cultural betrayal happens when you're betrayed by someone within your own cultural community, be it a racial or ethnic community, a faith community, or a community formed through kinship, shared sexuality, gender identity, or social background. Cultural betrayal can be particularly traumatizing because there's an even stronger expectation of loyalty, trust, and faithfulness among members of a cultural community because they're bonded by their shared identities and experiences. Judas and the other disciples all shared their ethnic identity, their gender identity, as far as we know, their Jewish identity, and their commitment to Jesus' ministry and mission. They were a cultural community. For Judas to seemingly betray their leader could have led to the other disciples feeling really traumatized by his disloyalty and infidelity.
Yeah, I completely agree. That makes sense. Although on saying that, Judas wasn't the only one to betray Jesus, was he?
Who are you referring to, Kez?
All the other disciples betrayed Jesus in a sense, given that they all fled the scene once Jesus was arrested. And I don't think all of them came to be with him at the crucifixion, did they? But I'm thinking particularly of Peter. Didn't he deny knowing Jesus on 3 separate occasions after Jesus' arrest?
Yeah, that's true. Peter's 3 denials are mentioned in Mark chapter 14, verses 66 to 72. But Peter seems to regret his betrayal almost immediately because we're told in verse 72 that after denying Jesus for the 3rd time, he broke down and wept. And certainly he seems to get forgiven, doesn't he? Because Peter is the disciple who is ultimately regarded as the foundation of the church.
I wonder if Judas also regretted what he'd done. Do you think he felt any remorse after Jesus was arrested?
Not all the Gospels mention what happens to Judas after Jesus' arrest. But the Gospel of Matthew does. Could you read it out, Kez?
Certainly. This is Matthew chapter 27, verses 3 to 8. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. "That's your responsibility." So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. Okay, so verse 3 tells us that Judas was seized with remorse. Remorse is another one of these emotions, like betrayal, that can really dig its claws into you.
Yeah, it really can. The word remorse comes from the Latin root mordere, which means to bite repeatedly on the past.
Oh, that captures it so perfectly.
It does, eh? I love it.
Yeah.
When we experience remorse, we have a very clear insight that we've done something wrong. We accept our guilt and recognize that our life has changed or may have to change as a result. We often have a strong desire to make up for what we've done in some way and to change our behavior so that we won't make the same mistake again.
So when Judas takes his 30 pieces of silver back to the temple, that could signal his remorse is genuine. He's trying to make restitution. He recognizes what he did was wrong and wants to distance himself from it.
Yeah, and his words, quote, "I have sinned in delivering up innocent blood," shows that he recognizes his own guilt. That sounds like genuine remorse to me. But I have a question for you, Kaz. If Judas was up in court today being tried for his betrayal, do you think his remorse would impact the outcome of his trial?
I would definitely suspect that his expression of remorse could make a difference, but only if it was believed to be genuine.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Sure. There have been quite a lot of studies done by criminologists and psychologists that show the defendant's remorse, or lack of remorse, can play a key role in jury decision-making, as well as judges' sentencing decisions. If a defendant isn't deemed remorseful, they may be more likely to be found guilty or get a lengthier or harsher sentence. We saw this in the case of the DC snipers. Have you heard of that case, Em?
Yeah, I think I have, but remind me of what happened.
During October of 2002, John Allen Muhammad and his accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, drove around the Washington area randomly shooting people in the street. All in all, they murdered 10 people and injured 3 others. Now, Malvo was given a sentence of life imprisonment, in part due to his age, he was only 17, but Muhammad received the death penalty, and one of the reasons for Muhammad's sentence was cited as his lack of remorse.
But surely determining someone's level of remorse is really subjective, isn't it? We all express our emotions differently depending on our gender, our age, our culture, and lots of other factors too.
Yeah, absolutely. A defendant's seeming lack of remorse might be due to their anxiety levels during the trial, or perhaps their defence lawyer has told them not to show any emotion in court. And what one person sees as genuine remorse might be interpreted by another person as crocodile tears and bad acting. A good example of that is the case of Brock Turner, who was convicted in 2016 on 3 charges of felony sexual assault against Chanel Miller.
Now, we've mentioned him in a previous episode, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. You may recall that Turner received a very short sentence of only 6 months, and that was due, in part at least, to the sentencing judge believing that Turner had shown genuine remorse. But his victim, Chanel Miller, didn't believe he was at all remorseful, and nor do a lot of people, including me. I read that statement Turner gave to the court, and what struck me is that he really focused on himself and how much his life had been ruined since the night of Chanel's assault. He had very little to say about Chanel or how much his actions had impacted her. And I'm not sure if he really owned his guilt either, because he blamed his behaviour solely on, and I quote, his poor decision-making and excessive drinking on the night of the assault. So for me, it's as though he's excusing his violent behaviour rather than owning it and expressing true remorse about it. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, like you say, it's as if he's saying that he regrets the impact his actions have had on his life, the disruption to his life, without recognising the profound and ongoing impact his violence had on his victim, Chanel Miller.
Exactly.
But getting back to Judas, we do have another indicator that his remorse was genuine to the point that it was too much for him to bear. He was biting on the past to such an extent that he took his own life.
That is such a tragic ending to Judas's life, no matter what we think about his act of betrayal. But I wonder how it impacted the remaining disciples. They'd lived and travelled with Judas for over 3 years. They've been in this really tight-knit community, experiencing some very intense times together. I'd have thought they would have been really traumatised by his death.
Well, the Gospels don't really mention how they felt about Judas. But in the opening chapter of the book of Acts, there's a scene where the disciples and other followers of Jesus meet in Jerusalem after witnessing the risen Jesus ascend up to heaven. And when Peter addresses them, he mentions Judas. Then the narrator jumps in to tell us, quote, "Now this man Judas acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out."
Ugh.
Yeah. Really gory. Then Peter goes on to explain that they need to find a replacement for Judas, someone who will continue, quote, "this ministry and apostleship from which Judas turned aside to go to his own place."
So I'm sorry, but what exactly is Peter saying happened to Judas? What was all that about him bursting open in a field?
Yeah, it's not entirely clear, but it sounds as though he self-combusted in some way. So this is less an act of suicide than perhaps an act of divine vengeance or some sort of horrible accident.
But that only serves to diminish or erase Judas's sense of remorse, doesn't it?
In what sense, Kez?
Well, in Matthew's gospel, his remorse is so deep that he returns the money and just can't live with himself anymore. Yet in Acts, Peter describes him as wicked and suggests that he actually bought a field with the 30 pieces of silver rather than returning it. What do you think Peter's motivation is for describing the events in this way?
Well, I guess it might just be another tradition about Judas that was circulating at the time. But in my suspicious mind, I wonder if there's something else going on.
Ooh, what do you think's happening?
So Peter's holding a meeting where he's trying to find Judas's replacement. He wants the tradition of the 12 disciples to continue. Now, maybe Peter's worried that the reputation of the 12 disciples has been tarnished by Judas's actions. After all, what kind of group has traitors in its midst? Maybe people would start to wonder if there's something wrong with the group's internal dynamics or its former leadership if one of its own members can behave so treacherously. So Peter might be trying to distance the disciples from Judas by painting him as an outlier, wicked through and through, nothing like the others. And in that way, he takes attention away from the possibility that there's something inherently problematic with the group, which made Judas behave in the way he did. And by not mentioning Judas's remorse or his suicide, Peter's audience are far less likely to sympathize with the disgraced disciple.
That's such an interesting reading of this text, and it completely makes sense because so often we hear about institutions who excuse the bad behaviour of individual members by claiming that they're so-called bad apples or rotten apples, rather than admitting their behaviour may have been caused by something intrinsically unhealthy about the institution itself.
Are you thinking of a specific example here, Kez?
Yes, I'm thinking of a recent case involving the Metropolitan Police Service in England, which is commonly referred to as the Met. Following the rape and murder of British woman Sarah Everard by a serving Met police officer in 2021, Baroness Louise Casey was commissioned to conduct an independent review into the Met's standards of behaviour and internal culture. Her report was published earlier this year, and I've had a look at it. It's a damning indictment of this police service as being institutionally racist, misogynistic, and homophobic. Baroness Casey highlighted a number of ways that the internal culture of the Met has allowed dangerous and toxic behaviour to flourish, including bullying, harassment, discrimination, and racist, homophobic, and misogynistic violence. And she blamed much of that on past leadership. Yet despite her report, some high-ranking members of the Met have been very reluctant to admit that the problem lies within the institution itself. Instead, they continue to put the blame on individual members. As they see it, the solution is to get rid of the bad apples and the problem goes away. But I'm sorry, you can weed out as many bad apples as you like. Nothing's going to get better until the institutional systems and processes that empower all these bad apples are dismantled and replaced.
Yeah, that's such a good example, which really captures what I'm thinking about in relation to that passage from Acts. Is Judas being painted as a bad apple in an effort to deflect attention from something toxic or malignant that's actually ingrained in the structures of this group? Is Peter trying to do a bit of damage control here by putting the blame on Judas alone? I find it interesting that in verse 25, Peter mentions that Judas turned aside from the group's ministry to, quote, go to his own place. So Judas's behaviour is framed here as something completely separate from this group that he was a long-term member of.
That's such a good point. And I think there's something similar might be happening in the Gospel of John 2, where Judas is presented as being a thieving hypocrite who's in league with the devil. In other words, he's a rotten apple and his behaviour doesn't reflect the group at all. And again, that reminds me of a contemporary case. Have you ever heard of Chris Benoit, Em?
Wasn't he a famous wrestler?
Yes, he was a professional wrestler, and at the time of his death, he was employed by the WWE, the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization. In June 2007, he murdered his wife Nancy and their 7-year-old son Daniel before taking his own life.
So tragic.
Yeah, it really, really is. Now, when the WWE initially heard that Chris had died, they aired a 3-hour tribute about him, eulogising him as one of their most talented wrestlers. But after they discovered he had murdered his wife and son, they very quickly distanced themselves from him. For example, they removed his name from their website, they stopped talking about him or airing any of his matches. Now, to some extent, I agree that was probably the right thing to do. But there was a lot of speculation that Benoit's violence against his family had been sparked by his misuse of steroids. And the WWE were heavily criticised in the media for being far too lax about their policing of steroid misuse among their members. So for some, the WWE's decision to effectively erase Benoit from their brand signalled an attempt to deflect attention from their own failures, which might have contributed to Benoit's murders.
So, in other words, the WWE might have wanted to distance themselves from Benoit in order to avoid their own institutional weaknesses being put in the spotlight.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's the most heartbreaking story. Were there ever any conclusions reached about what caused Benoit to murder his family and take his own life?
Nothing definitive, no. He was known to have suffered from depression, and there had also been a history of intimate partner violence in his marriage, which we know can be a precursor to fatal family violence. But a post-mortem also showed that he was suffering from extensive brain damage due to repeated head injuries during his career, and that may have been a contributing factor too. But it's just an awful tragedy for everyone concerned, especially Nancy and Daniel.
It absolutely is. And I really wish the WWE had taken the opportunity to talk openly to their other wrestlers and to fans about family violence, about mental illness, suicide, and the abuse of performance-enhancing drugs. It would also have been an opportunity to reflect on the dangers of repeated head injuries in sport. But I'm guessing that never happened?
No, I don't believe so. And the silence surrounding Benoit's murders and his suicide left his fans with a very fragmented image of who he was as a man. On the one hand, he had been a highly regarded sportsman, but on the other hand, he had committed the most heinous murders. And it was very difficult for his fans to hold these two conflicting ideas together, because Benoit's identity as a WWE wrestler dominated his persona, so it was really hard to see the real man underneath.
Yeah, and I think we can say the same about Judas. His persona was really dominated by his status as one of Jesus' 12 disciples. But that's really all we know about him, and it's against that aspect of his identity that we judge him for his betrayal of Jesus. Without knowing more about who he was and what he experienced during his time as a disciple, it's difficult to pinpoint the reasons for his actions.
Yes, and I'd also say it's hard to understand Judas without knowing more about the inner dynamics of the 12 disciples under Jesus' leadership. What was it like to be in that group? Were there pressures? Were there tensions? Was there something about the relationship dynamics that created an environment where Judas's betrayal could have been more understandable or even predictable?
Yeah, if only we knew.
I know, if only.
But sadly, the textual evidence we have leaves very little to go on. Okay, so I have one last question for you, Kaz. If you were to write a screenplay for a film about Judas, how would you depict him?
Aha, that's such a good question. I don't think I portray him as an out-and-out villain, like some of the older Jesus movies do. In light of what we've been talking about, I think I would focus on the inner group dynamics of the 12 disciples and Jesus and try to home in on how Judas might have experienced that. Now, drawing solely from my imagination, I might portray him as someone who's trying so hard to fit in, someone who's really committed to the cause, but becomes disenchanted because of the group's internal politics and clashes of personality. And I think I'd focus really strongly on his sense of remorse and how that hit him so hard. But I'd also offer him, or try to offer him, a redemptive ending, in some sense at least.
Okay. And who would you want to play the role of Judas in your film?
I am actually torn between two options. It would either be Ben Whishaw or Shruti Gatwa.
Isn't Shruti Gatwa going to be the next Doctor Who?
Yes, he is. I have these two actors on my shortlist because I find them both so incredibly likeable, whatever role they play. And I think it would be fascinating to see Judas portrayed as someone with the capacity to be warm and generous, smart, funny, passionate, rather than a greedy or devilish villain. So, Em, what about you? What's your Judas film going to look like?
I just realised as you were talking that you'd turn this question back on me. Well played, Kaz, well played.
You're welcome.
Well, I think my response is in part influenced by Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. And I think I'd want to explore the relationship between Jesus and Judas in much more depth. What if Judas's actions were not the worst betrayal imaginable, but the ultimate expression of loyalty and love and friendship? What if Jesus recognized that he had to die and actually conspired with Judas to make this happen? What if their bond was so strong, their affection for each other so great, that Judas agreed to sell Jesus out, despite what it would ultimately cost him?
That's such an interesting take on the story. And again, it frames Judas as more of a tragic figure than a villain. I like it.
Why, thank you, Kaz.
So before we go, shall we share with the listeners what we've been reading or listening to this week?
Yeah, okay. So I want to talk about a book called My Name Was Judas, published a while ago now in 2006 by New Zealand author C.K. Stead, and part of my movie response, I think, is influenced by this book as well. So this story takes as its starting point the idea that Judas didn't in fact take his own life or live in an agony of guilt, but changes his name and becomes a respected citizen in Egypt. We read Judas's own account of the Judas movement some 40 years after the fact. Looking back on his childhood and youth from an old age, Judas recalls his friendship with Jesus, their schooling together, their families, the people who would go on to be disciples and followers, their journeys together, and their dealings with the powers of Rome and the temple. It's a really great retelling and touches on a number of the points we've talked about today. It's well worth a read if you're into novels.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I've heard of it, but I've never read it. So that makes me want to check it out for sure.
And what about you, Kaz?
I'm a bit late to the party with my choice, but I've been working my way through the final three seasons of the TV drama called Endeavour, which recounts the early days of the very famous fictional detective Inspector Morse, who was a character initially created by the author Colin Dexter. Now, the reason I thought of it just now is that the theme of betrayal and the devastating pain of betrayal comes out so powerfully in the episodes I've been watching. And the character of Morse, played by the wonderful Sean Evans, captures so beautifully that betrayal trauma you mentioned earlier, Em. If any of our listeners haven't watched Endeavour, I'd strongly recommend it. It's set in 1960s and early 1970s Oxford, in England, and each episode has a fascinating mystery at its heart. There are also some really unforgettable characters, and it is beautifully filmed as well. So all round, a real treat to watch.
Thanks for that. I have not watched it, so we'll definitely get onto that.
Oh, please do. Yeah.
Well, I'm off to write the screenplay for my Oscar-winning Judas movie. I will send you some royalties from my private island, Kaz.
You are too generous, Em.
But before we go, thank you for listening to this episode of The Bloody Bible. And as usual, you'll find the show notes on our website, along with the links to our social media accounts.
But until next time, we will sign off and say goodbye. Stay safe, everyone.
Bye.
The Bloody Bible podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council, as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. Special thanks to Professor Johanna Stiebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us to create the podcast and supported us into this second season. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and myself, Richard Bonifant, who also recorded and edited each episode, whilst apologising profusely on behalf of all men. Our music is Stalker by Alexis Ortiz Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. Our social media links are found in the notes to this episode. Please leave us a 5-star review. Thanks for listening.